Janet Hammond, taking the King's Daughters, he just birthed her.
Oh, okay. Just tonight? Yeah. Just now? Okay. Well, we certainly need to be thinking, praying for that. I don't know, is Mark going to come back, or did he have more info on that? Or? Well, maybe we'll find out more later, and maybe we can have a prayer for him, too. Turn to Numbers 15, as we continue our trek through these four books. And last week, they came to Kadesh Barnea. They sent the spies into the land. The spies came back.
You have a Bible?
Here's a Bible. I don't know if it's a big enough print, but... Actually, I have one in the car.
I need to get pressed to think. Jerry, he's not going to get kidnapped, I guarantee you. You don't need to keep your eye on me, he's not
going to
get kidnapped.
Yeah. Certainly getting you a Bible, not saying he's getting kidnapped. I'd trade him off for a Bible.
That should be big enough.
Yeah, it's big enough.
Okay, are we all ready?
Yeah.
All right. So, they sent the spies, we mentioned last week, into the land. There was the evil report brought back, 10 of the spies saying we can't take it. And the judgment, the punishment, was that they were to wander in the wilderness for how many years?
40.
And how was that determined?
1 year for every day.
1 year for every day they spied the land. Now, in chapters 15 through 19... we have just a few events that record the majority of those 40 years. About 38 years of the wanderings are contained in these few chapters. And interesting, all that time, it only covers these few events. You know, that's the way the Bible is. It gives us what we need. It doesn't give us detail about absolutely everything. And the first chapter, in chapter 15, that we're going to study tonight, I'd like to kind of give a big idea for the chapter, even though there's a lot of different things that are going on, so we can kind of focus on it. I think the big idea is the idea of a reminder of God's commands. What he starts talking about at the beginning, verses 1 through 21, is he reminds them of some of the offerings, and he gives them specific amounts of meal or oil or wine that needs to accompany some of their offerings. And, of course, in the book of Leviticus, we looked at this more in detail. We're not going to spend much time here tonight. But you notice, the more expensive or valuable and the larger the animal, the larger the portion that they offered with it. For instance, if it was a fourth a hen of wine, or a third a hen of wine, or half a hen, you know, it all kind of was gradiated so that, you know, you would give more. And that goes along with the principle that you give as you're prospered, and something that's more... more important or more valuable, you give along with that. Now, there were instructions given for offerings for sin committed unwittingly, that is, unintentional sins. There was one delineated here for the congregation. There was also one delineated for the individual. But then we come to verse 30, and it talks about presumptuous sins. That is high-handed sins. That is a challenge against authority. And is there a sacrifice for that given? No, there's not. So there's a difference in the way that God approaches sins of ignorance or sins of unintentional sins and presumptuous sins. That is a high-handed sin. And don't you see this in the way that Jesus dealt with people in the New Testament? For instance, do you all need...
Do you know any more about that? Do you know anything else about Janet?
We maybe have a prayer here after class for us. In the New Testament with Jesus, think about the way, for instance, when he and Martha, he got after Martha. You remember Martha wanted Mary to help her prepare the meal? And he says, "Martha, Martha, you're troubled and careful over much things." Wasn't that different in the way that he dealt with that than the way that he dealt with, for instance, the Pharisees and the Sadducees? You know, when he says, "How can you escape the damnation of hell?" You know, well, there's difference in you know, in people, and there's also difference in the way somebody approaches sin. And so, if it's unintentional, there's a difference between that and between a challenge against authority, which was this high-handed sin. And then they're reminded of the Sabbath law. There is a man that is picking up sticks on the Sabbath day. And he knew that it was wrong, but he was doing it anyway. Now, what did the law say? What did the law say about a man, you know, picking up or working on the Sabbath day?
Picking up stones.
Yeah, basically, the Exodus 20 says if you, you know, work on the Sabbath day, you are to be killed. So they ask what the word of the Lord is, and the Lord says, "You stone him." And so, a very serious thing done here. You know, the work was to be done in the 6 days. It was not to be done in the seventh day. They weren't even supposed to kindle a fire on the seventh day. And death penalty was described at the end of the book of Exodus for somebody that worked on the Sabbath day. And that's exactly what the Lord tells them to do here. Interestingly enough, in the New Testament, many times Jesus gets in trouble with the religious leaders because they say he has broken the Sabbath. He really hasn't, right? But what happened was when they were in captivity, the Babylonian Talmud was something that was kind of a commentary, so to speak, on the law. But the first part of it, they actually added hundreds of laws to the law. And so there were laws on the law that that Jesus was breaking. He wasn't actually breaking the law himself. It was the way the rabbis over the years did the things or interpreted the law. And the interesting thing is, though, do you usually find people killing people in the New Testament for breaking the Sabbath? What they thought was breaking the Sabbath? No. So, in a sense, weren't they, didn't they judge what they were saying as far as you know, what somebody had done wrong? In a sense, weren't they judging that as not important enough? Because they really wouldn't carry through with it, right? And I see the same thing with people today. You can tell how serious somebody is about a command as far as what they're going to do about it, you know. For instance, if somebody says, no, nobody should ever be, you know, doing that, and, well, are you going to discipline somebody about that, or is fellowship going to be withdrawn from that? You know, you can see how serious somebody is as to whether or not they'll actually do something about it. So they talked a lot about it in the New Testament, but they really didn't carry through with it in many ways. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I don't think they carried out the death penalty very much throughout the history of Israel in their practice of the law, even though they had built a lot of laws around it. Now, this man had violated it, and so the Lord told him to be put to death. Now, there are some things in the New Testament that we learn from this as far as the severity of it. You know, it does seem kind of severe for somebody to be picking up sticks and they're killed for it, right? But, you know, the book of Hebrews has somewhat to say about this. It says in Hebrews 2, verses 1 through 4, it talks about if they neglected the Old Testament law and they were punished, what do you think will happen to us? How shall we escape, right? Hebrews 2 says, if we neglect so great salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him. So the point there, you know, Hebrews 1 is a contrast between Jesus and the angels, and says Jesus is so much greater than the angels. And the Old Testament law was given by the angels, and so if Jesus gives this New Testament law, then we're under even more obligation to obey it than they were under the Old Testament. So people tend to say, well, God in the Old Testament was a stickler for things, and under the New Testament, he's not really as concerned. That's not true. You know, I mean, some people might skew it that way, but the Bible says clearly in Hebrews that we're even more responsible. Hebrews 10, talks about sore punishment. How much sore punishment shall they be thought who have, you know, somebody that has willfully gone against the Lord's commands? I mean, under the Old Testament, they received their just punishment. And then 1 Corinthians 10, verses 5 through 12, talk about how these punishments of the Old Testament are given to us as an example. They're written for our admonition. Now, the great thing about the New Testament is that there is that grace that is built in. There is forgiveness of sin there, and it's not so much a law, pure law system as the Old Testament was. But we should not think that the Lord just doesn't care or has become lax under the New Testament. In fact, we have all the more reason to obey. And then finally, another reminder that they gave was that they were to put tassels of blue or fringes of blue on their garments to remember God's commandments. And if you go to the New Testament, they seem to be still doing that then. I suppose some Jews may even do it still today in their dress. You remember when Jesus is headed to Jairus' house? Because Jairus' daughter is sick, and there's this woman that had an issue of blood, you know, for several years, and she had spent all her money on doctors. She couldn't get healed. And so, remember what she did? She touched the hem of Jesus' garment. Perhaps that is a reference, actually, to the fringe that was on Jesus' garment, which would be carrying out this command here in Numbers chapter 15 to remember the Lord's commands by putting the fringe there as a memorial for them. Okay, chapter 16. They had to be reminded of the Lord's commands in verse 15. Now they commit some rebellion, and they have to be reminded of the Lord's commands again, or the Lord's choosing of leadership. The rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Is found here in the 250 princes of the congregation, found here in chapter 16. Now, Korah seems to be of the sons of Kohath, which were the sons of Levi. So he was a Levite, but he wasn't in the priest's office because he wasn't, he wasn't under the same line that Aaron was. Dathan and Abiram were sons of Eliab. They were of the tribe of Reuben. And then 200 men of renown of the congregation. And they basically come to Moses and Aaron and say, you know, you take too much upon yourself. Why do you set yourself up as being some, you know, some great people? All of the congregation is holy. But what do you think was the cause or the source, the motivation for them speaking against them thus? What motivated them to do this?
Jealousy. They wanted authority. They wanted power.
They were envious of what God had given Moses and Aaron, right? And Moses is no stranger to this type of treatment, right? I mean, earlier Aaron and Miriam kind of did a similar thing, right? So it's envy. They're rebelling against authority. They're speaking against Moses and Aaron. And Moses proposes a way to determine God's choice. He says, take censers, put fire therein, you know, burning coals, and come before the Lord, and the Lord will choose who is the one that he has chose to lead. And so this is the way that he proposes that tomorrow they do this. Not all of them come. I mean, Dathan and Abiram refused to come up. They accused Moses of leading them out so he could be a prince over them. He said he hadn't fulfilled his promise. So they stand at the doors of their tents, and Moses speaks unto them, tells them what God sent him to do. And basically, the Lord said, I mean, Moses says, if God kills them in a new way, an extraordinary way, then you'll know that it's because the Lord's judgment is on them. And what happens? The earth opens up and closes over these people, and all the other people were supposed to remove from them. Now, doesn't this tell us a lot about as far as God selecting certain people to be in authority? How does God feel towards disrespect for authority? He doesn't take kindly to it, right? In the New Testament, there's a lot said about authority, right? In fact, I would say that that's one of the major themes of the book of Ephesians and the book of 1 Peter. It's especially the book of 1 Peter. Both of those have concluding statements that, or starting statements that kind of sum up the whole thing. You know, for instance, in Ephesians chapter 5, he says, submit yourselves one to another in the Lord. And then he details the way in which it needs to happen, right? So right after that in Ephesians 5, the first thing he says is, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, right? Chapter 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, right? And then later on he talks about servants and masters. 1 Peter is a book that's all about submitting, whether it is to suffering or whether it is to to certain people we need to submit to, whether it's servants to masters or citizens to the government or wives to husbands. You know, whatever way it is, the Lord's commanded us to submit to the God-given authority. What about in the church? Suppose God has chosen a certain thing. For instance, God has chosen men to be elders in the church. Man must be a husband of one wife. Some people say, well, it's no big deal if there's a woman elder. Well, what's the difference? What's the difference between what they're doing here, taking too much upon themselves and changing God's order, in Numbers chapter 16. So a very good lesson that we learn from that. So the ground swallows them up, the 250 princes are consumed by fire, and their censers, which were brought before the Lord, they are taken and they are hammered or laid over, cover the altar. It was a sign to the children of Israel that no one out of the seed of the seed of Aaron would ever come near to offer incense again. Aaron's seed was the one that was chosen. Well, this doesn't stop the murmuring completely, because then Moses and Aaron are accused of killing the people of God. So the glory of the Lord appears in the tabernacle, and a plague begins to consume them, and so Moses tells Aaron to go out and make atonement for him. He stands between the people, makes atonement for them. And so basically the final conclusion is people are saying, we're going to die, we're going to perish. And they actually had some fear for the Lord. They had healthy fear. And so it is possible over the years for people to begin to disrespect people in authority. And that's not ever a good mixture. And so they needed to be reminded of that. And you remember what we said, Numbers chapter 1, they had 603,550. We're going to come next week to chapter 26 where they have less. This is one of the reasons right here, because the Lord has to discipline some of them by killing them.
It's hard to imagine that you just witness that one day and the next day you start complaining. But when Aaron and Moses would take swords and kill them, something different. But when you see the ground open up, I mean, you're pretty sure that Moses and Aaron didn't do that of their own free will.
That's right.
Somebody else took care of that.
Yeah.
14,000 of them died during that lesson.
Now, God also instructs them as far as Aaron's leadership, kind of reinforces this idea by the rod that buds. What happens is, Numbers chapter 1, you find a list of princes for each tribe. And so each one of these take their rod and they write their name on the rod. And they take all the rods and they lay them before the tabernacle there. And the rod that would bud, that would be the one the Lord would choose. Well, of course, after they take all of them and bring them before the Ark of the Covenant, which rod buds? It's Aaron's rod. And so Aaron's rod is placed in the Ark of the Covenant. It serves as a token or a sign to those that rebel. It caused the murmurings to cease against God and against Moses. And so it clearly demonstrated Aaron's leadership again. So it was kept as a memorial of the fact that Aaron was to be in his position of spiritual leadership, and they weren't to speak against that. And then in chapter, chapter 18, we have a division kind of given between Aaron and his sons, how they're to wait. I guess I have an extra H there, don't need that. On the altar within the veil, and the Levites were to assist them in the services. So I think that's also given because the Levites were trying to take a little more upon themselves than they should have, and they tried to put themselves in the place of even Aaron or even Moses. And so again, the difference is highlighted for them between Aaron and his sons and the rest of the Levites and what they're supposed to do. Does anybody have any comments or questions on that before we move on to the next chapter? Sorry we can't talk about these things in more detail, but doing the best we can with what we've got. So thanks for bearing with me. Okay, now chapter 19, we have this water of purification, this water of cleansing. And I think the spiritual significance of this is throughout the entire Bible, one of the biggest themes is cleansing from moral and spiritual ills and corruption. And this was given especially for somebody that had become unclean. And so this is the thing that they had to do in order to wash, in order to become clean. Now, Matthew Henry gives several references to the sacrifice of Christ. You notice there I say some of them might go beyond the warrant. Sometimes I wonder if maybe people go and give a bunch of typology and stuff like this because they really don't know what to do with the text. That might be the case. Now, some of these I think fit. Some of them I think may go a little bit beyond the warrant, like I said. But he does mention these, and you can see what you think about this. Comparisons between the red heifer that was supposed to be given in the water of purification and Jesus. It was spotless and without blemish. Of course, Jesus was as well. It was red. This is the one. Some of these are a little far-fetched, but they might work. Christ was a son of the red earth, red in his apparel, red in his own blood, red with the blood of his enemies. The sacrifice was wholly burnt. The extreme suffering of Christ showed there. The ashes were kept for posterity. The Jews said in nearly 1,000 years they kept them. And it was sufficient for all the people, which Jesus' sacrifice was as well. But I think a really interesting thing in this water of purification is the actual practical value that it had for their physical cleansing. Because this command was given to people that were unclean. Now, somebody became unclean because either they had leprosy or they touched a dead body or they're in a place where other things become unclean. And so the very spread of diseases is at stake here. And notice some of these things that really serve as beneficial ingredients to becoming clean today. For instance, the ashes of a red heifer. Now, I've never made my own soap, but if you look at how to make live soap, many of the ingredients include pouring water through ashes. And so lye in high concentrations is actually caustic to the skin. It actually is one of the main ingredients in your Drano, your drain cleanser. But in a more diluted solution, it helps to cleanse the skin like soap would. And Moses is instructing them to make a diluted solution here. Hyssop contains the antiseptic thymol, found in some mouthwashes, and a mold that produces penicillin grows on the leaves of hyssop. Cedar wood, sometimes people have made cabinets out of cedar and stuff like that to ward off insects, but in oil form, cedar can be used, for an antiseptic, astringent, expectorant, to remove mucus, antifungal, sedative, insecticide, has a lot of vitamin C, so could help in curing scurvy. It also has been affected in inhibiting influenza virus type A and treating eczema. And then to all of this, scarlet fibers were added. And the purpose or the help to that is, I don't know if anybody here has ever used lava soap, but the kind of the scour of the skin. So it's interesting how all of these kind of fit together. And Kyle Butt has some good information on this in his book, Behold the Word of God. So I recommend that to you. It's interesting how the Lord gave them these things to be clean, and they didn't even understand the science behind it or the medical knowledge behind it, but they could still use them. And certainly none of the diseases of the other nations affected the Jews. They were set apart as far as being a clean people as well. So God took care of his people medically, which is very interesting. Anybody else on that? Okay, we have to move along. So, Moses and Aaron sin at Kadesh. Yeah, I give you just a split second. That's all you're going to get. What was the problem at Kadesh?
No water.
No water. Now, I don't know about you, the first few times I read through the Old Testament, I didn't really, you know, I guess I wasn't fathoming how great the number of people is. And I guess when I thought that he struck the rock, maybe a little trickle came out and people could line up like a water fountain and drink of it. But how many people were out here in the wilderness?
3 million.
Yeah, 3 million. So I think the idea is that it bursts out of the rock and creates this big stream. And then everybody comes down to the stream in order to get water. So this, you know, obviously if you have 3 million people, you're going to need quite a bit of water for all the things they have to do throughout the day. So the people, again, they chide with Moses, they complain. And so Moses is told to take his rod and go and speak to the rock before their eyes and water will come out. He's supposed to gather all the people, speak to the rock before their eyes. Now, how does Moses, what does Moses do? How does he follow or not follow this command? Yeah, now earlier on, he was told to strike the rock, but this time he's told to smite it, right? And so he strikes it, and then also, what else does he do? What does he say?
We must die and get water.
Yeah, hear now, you rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? Taps it twice. Now the water comes out. But then God calls Moses and Aaron to him and says, you failed to sanctify me in the eyes of the people. Now, the first part, you know, we've noted this several times in Bible classes. Just because God commanded something earlier didn't mean that it was approved for later on, right? He could have struck the rock earlier. He was actually commanded to earlier on when they needed water in the book of Exodus. You know, Exodus 17, when they needed water, he struck the rock. But here, just because God had said strike it before didn't mean that he could do it later. Well, same thing today. You know, when we talk about things in the Old Testament that they were commanded to do, can we carry those to the New Testament? Obviously not. That's very simple. Principle, a basic principle that we've learned. But another thing on top of that is the idea of sanctifying him. Now, what does it mean to sanctify?
Set apart.
So, when he says, must we, what is he doing? He's kind of including himself, him and Aaron, maybe including himself with God, or not, just leaving God out of the picture, but in either case, he's saying that he has something to do with it, right? So, God is not being set apart and holy in the sight of the people. And so because of that, the Lord is angry. Now, I don't know about you, but this is such a sad story to me because I think about all that Moses put up with and all that he went through, and yet, because of this, he's not going to get to go into the promised land. Somebody says, well, can one act, I mean, will God really judge you for one act? There's been people that have asked me that before. Well, it only took one act for Moses to be kept out of the promised land, right? It only took one act for Adam and Eve to lose paradise, right? Now, you can be forgiven of it, but one act can have a lot of consequences, right? And just because you're forgiven doesn't mean that you don't have some consequences. So, of course, I think Moses was saved. Matthew 17 says he appears in glory. He's in the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews 11. But he still has to suffer some consequences for what he does here. I think I might have been told I wasn't going to go in the promised land much earlier than Moses. He's a very meek man, but he had his limits, you know, just like everybody else. So so that's what happens here. Does Aaron have anything to do with the sin? Yeah, he's punished as well. And in fact, it talks about how, you know, chapter 20, verse 24, when, you know, Aaron died before he got to see the land, it mentions the fact that he failed to believe the Lord and didn't separate him, sanctify him. So Aaron was guilty as well. Chapter 20, that section of it, the next part of chapter 20, we have the death of Aaron and Miriam. Miriam dies at Kadesh Barnea, which was the spot where they went to spy the land. Now, let's look at you can look at a few highlights of Miriam's life if you want. You know, of course, she watched over Moses when he was in the basket of bulrushes going down the Nile River. She led the women in songs after they went through the Red Sea in Exodus 15. She spoke to against Moses at Hazeroth, her and Aaron did, and she was spoke with leprosy. She was a helper to Moses and Aaron as deliverers of Israel, Micah 6 says, and she was the daughter of Amram and Jochebed. Aaron died at the age of 123 years old, and he died at the top of Mount Hor. We don't know exactly where that is, but it's somewhere around here, I guess. And who took his place? Yeah, his son Eleazar. And this was actually done officially. They went up to the top of Mount Hor, and Moses was stripped Aaron of his garments, and he put them on Eleazar, his son. And so Eleazar then became the next high priest. Now, this next section, they're traveling towards Moab, and they come across a lot of enemies along the way. So we're going to talk about some of those here. First of all, the Canaanites come and take some prisoners from them. Now, with all of these people, they're not very friendly towards Israel. And I know that they probably still remember what had happened in Egypt, but they probably also have maybe heard that they spied the land. Maybe they've heard that by now. And they kind of are figuring out what they're planning on doing. And so even though this is 40 years later, they maybe made some enemies. So the Canaanites come, they actually take some prisoners, but Israel vows to the Lord, if you give give us the victory, we'll destroy all the cities of the Canaanites. So the Lord does that. The place is called Hormah, which is complete destruction, which fits along with that description. Now, the people complain yet again here in Numbers 21. And their complaint this time is that the way is hard, the way that the Lord's leading them. And again, no water. And again, they don't like the bread that they have to eat. So kind of all the complaints thrown together here, right? Now notice, this is the last instance we find of them recorded of them murmuring. I think maybe they're finally taught their lesson this time. I don't know. But the Lord sends among them fiery serpents and the means of forgiveness is what?
The brazen pole.
The brazen pole. Now, you have a record of all the murmurings that they went through, there on the page. And when you think about what Moses had to put up with, those are just recorded instances. But they send the Lord sends fiery serpents, the serpents bite the people, they begin to die. So the salvation is found in Moses being told to make this serpent of brass, setting it on a pole, and everybody that looked on it would be healed. Now, is there any power in the pole of brass? What if somebody says, well, I believe with all my heart that that will save me, but I'm not going to go out there and look at it. Would that work? So, we've established a few things that really point out some eternal lessons, right? That salvation can be, whatever God has delineated or set as a prerequisite, God can do that. And there's no power necessarily in the thing itself, it's just in the fact that you're obeying God's command. Same thing. And so this is where the relief is given, looking up at the serpent of brass. Now, interestingly enough, later on, they actually use it as an object of worship. 2 Kings 18, verse 4, we find that they had to destroy it because the people were bowing down and worshiping it. Maybe they thought that there was some inherent power in the bronze serpent. Then in the New Testament, there's some references to it. Obviously, Jesus talking about John 3. He says, if he's lifted up from the earth, he'll draw all men to him. He can be the cure for the venom of sin. And so there, you see that type there. Now, we have these two folks that are talked about some more in the book of Deuteronomy. We'll just cover them briefly here. First one is, his name is Sihon, king of the Amorites. The Amorites were descendants of Canaan by Ham. And his kingdom's located between the Arnon and the Jabbok. Those are two tributaries that come off east of the Jordan River. So they're there just east of the land of Canaan. That's where Sihon, his kingdom was. And really, Israel had said, just let me pass through your land. We'll go by the king's highway. We won't disturb anything. But would Sihon have anything to do with it? No, he wouldn't. So he comes out and gathers his people against them. And of course, the Lord's with Israel, so Israel destroys him. And so now this territory is actually extra territory that wasn't originally intended. And so it's going to be given to Reuben and Gad. And of course, they're going to have to send their men over to help with the rest of the territory. But they're going to settle on this east side of the river of Jordan. And then Og, king of Bashan, is a territory farther to the north, just north of this. It went from the Arnon to the to Mount Hermon. Now, Og seems to be a pretty big man. Talks about in the book of Deuteronomy his bed. And it says his bed was 9 cubits long, 13.5 feet long, and 4 cubits wide, 6.5 feet wide. So that was a king-sized bed. Maybe that's where that comes from. I don't know. Apparently Bashan had at least 60 walled cities, 80 said walled cities, beside ones that weren't walled. So quite a big territory, or a lot of cities in it, and it was given to half the tribe of Manasseh. Okay, now the rest of the story for tonight is dealings here with the Moabites and some things that happened because of Balaam's counsel to Balak. We have this great story of Balaam and Balak. And don't you love the story? It's, on the surface, Balaam says all the right things, doesn't he? I can't go beyond what the Lord tells me. I'm just going to speak the word of the Lord. He doesn't mean that, does he? We find that out as things go along. But, you know, the people like that today. Oh, I'm going to speak what the Lord says, but the way that they act, that you can tell their interests are elsewhere. Now, Balak, he was the king of Moab, but he was actually a Midianite that had taken control or had become king of Moab. That's important to remember when you get over later on here to the next chapter, when they commit fornication with the women of Moab, and then all of a sudden a Midianite-ish woman is brought into the camp. Remember that that he is a Midianite, but he's king over Moab. Where did the Moabites come from? Where were they descendants from? Yeah, remember that story in Genesis 19, that fine commentary on alcohol, where, you know, both the daughters of Lot are, you know, there escaped from the city, and they lay with their father, and because of that, the eldest one, you get the Moabites. And Balak, he gets kind of afraid because Sihon and Og have both been destroyed, and so he wants to have Balaam curse the Israelites. Balaam, son of Beor, seems to have lived in Pethor of Mesopotamia, and he sends a bunch of princes to Balaam and says, I want you to curse the Israelites. And of course, Balaam asks the Lord, where the Lord. The Lord says, no, we're not going to curse them. They're a blessed people. And so he tells Balak, I can't do that. Well, then Balak says, well, I'll give you, he gives him even more notorious and better princes than the first. And this is where, this all starts. He wants him to come with him and curse him from maybe a different place. So notice here God's commands to Balaam. First of all, God commanded Balaam not to go with the men, right? And then we find that, when he offers it, God tells him to go. But in reading through this account, unless you read other places in the Bible, you don't really feel the full picture of it. Because God told him to go, but that's not really what he ultimately wanted to happen, right? Because as he went, what happened along the way? He's riding on his donkey, and the donkey sees the angel, right? And crushes his foot against the wall, and so he's about ready to smite his donkey, and then all of a sudden the donkey starts talking to him, which I guess doesn't really faze him at the time, right? Doesn't seem strange at all, I guess, to him. And the Lord really rebukes him through the donkey. In fact, Peter says that he was rebuked through the donkey. He talks about this in 2 Peter 2 and verse 15 beginning. But Balaam is called by Balak to go to all these different places to set up, you know, Balaam tells him to set up altars and curse the people from here or from here. What is the misconception here, you think? Well, what is Balak thinking that, okay, well, we can't curse him from this mountain. Maybe let's go to this mountain. What do you think the misconception is here?
Would it be different gods or different idols on different mountains?
That's what I tend to think. You know, that, for instance, you know, later on, who is it that's fighting against the Israelites, and they say that their gods are gods of the valleys, but not of the plains, you know. So they thought that different gods were part of different localities, right? And, you know, Jacob found that out, you know, at Bethel. When he was traveling, he found out that the Lord was God over everything, right? So I think that's kind of what lies behind it here. And they're just trying to do whatever they can, whatever hocus pocus will work, to try to kind of curse these people. They're kind of grasping at straws here. Now, again and again, Balaam talks about his loyalty. He says, I can't go beyond the word of the Lord. The word that God puts in my mouth, that shall I speak. You know, I can't go beyond his commandment. But he really shows his true attitude by what he counsels Balak to do. Now, you don't really find a lot of this in the Numbers account. But if you go over to some accounts in the New Testament, you kind of find what he did. If you turn over to the book of Revelation, chapter 2, the Bible is the best commentary on itself, and it kind of shows us a little bit about what Balaam did in order to help Balak to have the people cursed. Somebody want to read verse 14?
Revelation 2, verse 14.
Yeah.
For I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to the idols, to commit fornication.
Okay, so when we go into the next chapter, and all of a sudden the Moabite women are enticing the Israelite men to commit fornication with them and then to eat meals to that false god, you know, Baal. Where do you think that came from? Well, Revelation points us to where it came from, right? Whose suggestion was it? It was Balaam's, right? And Balaam, he talked about his loyalty to the Lord, but why is it that he followed Balak everywhere? Well, look at Jude, verse 11. It says, woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward. His real motivation is he wanted the riches that Balak was offering him, right? That's why he followed him. That's why he was going to all those different places. He wouldn't have continued to fool with Balak if he was really faithful to God. So it's interesting how the Bible kind of gives us more of a fuller picture with other inspired accounts later on in the New Testament. So that's exactly what happens here. And Balaam is killed in battle, we find out, chapter 31, verse 8. Any other questions or comments on Balaam and Balak? Okay. Now let's finally talk about this sin at Peor. The people commit fornication and idolatry with the women of Moab. We've identified the source, the motivation behind it. If they couldn't get the prophet to curse Israel, they could certainly get Israel in trouble, and then the people would be cursed. So they're punished. 23,000 of them are killed in one day. And at first it kind of seems confusing, because you're talking about Moabite women, and then all of a sudden there's this man, Zimri, that brings in Cosby, a Midianite woman. I thought we were talking about Moabite women. Well, I suppose that both were involved in this. And you remember what I said, that the king, Balak, was a Midianite? So maybe there was a conspiracy with multiple nations to kind of because they abhorred the Israelites to kind of cast a stumbling block before them. And they used the women in order to do that. Now, Phinehas is very zealous, isn't he? He sees this man bring this woman to the camp, and what does Phinehas do?
Javelin.
So he puts an end to it, right? You talk about somebody having zeal. I think Brad Poe mentioned this a few classes ago in this FBI. But think about Paul in the New Testament and how he was persecuting Christians. Don't you think Paul looked at examples like this of having zeal? You know, the Bible says that he was zealous for the traditions of his fathers above all of his equals, right? So, I kind of see this kind of as an example that Paul might have looked to. And Phinehas is, you know, certainly rewarded for doing something about it. None of the other judges are doing anything about it. And so he makes it, puts a stop to it, puts an end to it quickly. And he's willing to carry out the command of the Lord. God told Israel to vex and smite Moab. That's supposed to be Moab, not Israel, sorry. And again, like we pointed out, Balaam was the one behind advising this. So in the next chapter, when we start out, we're going to be looking at another census that is taken. We've kind of covered the wanderings. The rest of the book of Numbers, we're going to be talking about the preparation of the new generation in order to go into the land. And really, the book of Deuteronomy is the final one of that, because Moses is going to prepare them by giving them a sermon to remember the word of the Lord as they go into the land. I know we covered a lot tonight. Hope I didn't put anybody to sleep. But thanks for listening. Any other comments or questions before we stop?
Just an insight for you. You're kind of young, but I think the donkey's name was Francis. You have to look at there used to be a show I called Francis the Talking Mule.
Yeah.